This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Mastering the Zone by Barry Sears, PhD, as read by the author. Mastering the Zone sounds very New Age, like Yoda teaching Luke Skywalker about the Force. But it's not. Instead, it's very similar to the advice your grandmother gave you about eating. Eat everything in moderation. Eat lots of fruits and vegetables, and have some protein at every meal. Your grandmother didn't know it, but she was teaching you the basic principles for developing a lifelong strategy of hormonal balance. If you can achieve this hormonal balance, you are well on your way to the zone. What is the zone? It's the balance of hormonal responses that occur every time you eat. And why should you get in it? Simply said, if you can keep yourself in the zone, then you will think better because you are maintaining stable blood sugar levels, perform better because being in the zone allows you to increase oxygen transfer to your muscle cells, and look better because you are shedding excess body fat at the fastest possible rate and never be hungry between meals. Staying in the zone means your brain is being constantly supplied with its primary fuel, blood sugar. The reason you want to stay in the zone on a lifetime basis is to achieve super health. In a state of super health, you will reduce the likelihood of developing chronic disease, the type of illness that represents the bulk of our health care cost. The only way to obtain super health is to take control of your diet, and to use it to keep yourself in the zone on a continual basis. The more time you spend in the zone, the more control you have over the ultimate quality of your life. For those of you already in the zone, this audiobook offers new information on making the zone part of your lifelong routine. From tips on eating out and shopping, to adjusting the zone diet to your own body chemistry. Once you use these tips, getting into the zone and staying there becomes second nature, because you will be eating the foods you already like to eat and adapting the recipes you currently use every day into great zone meals. Let me present the zone on a plate. Every time you eat, make sure your carbohydrates come with a protein chaser and a dash of fat. To be a little more precise, for every cup of vegetables, or 1/2 a piece of fruit, or 1/4 a cup of pasta that you plan to eat, add 1 ounce of low-fat protein like chicken or fish. Then add a bit of monounsaturated fat, like a little olive oil or a few slivered almonds. Do this at every meal and snack, and presto, you're pretty close to being in the zone for the next 4 to 6 hours. And during that 4 to 6 hour period, you will be thinking better, performing better, losing stored body fat, and all without hunger. This audiobook will teach you how. To eat in the zone is to treat food with the same respect you would give a prescription drug. However, this doesn't mean food must taste like a drug. On the contrary, zone cooking allows for great tasting food packed with maximum nutrition. Mastering the zone is a recipe for lifelong hormonal control, a recipe that pretty much lets you forget about counting calories or grams of fat. Once you understand what the zone is and how it works, you will also understand that virtually every dietary recommendation made by the U.S. government and leading nutritional experts is hormonally dead wrong. What is their recommendation? Eat a high carbohydrate diet. Unfortunately, these authorities seem to have forgotten that the best way to fatten cattle is to feed them excessive amounts of low-fat grain. This is also the best way to fatten humans, by feeding them excessive amounts of low-fat grain in the form of pasta and bagels. One popular dietary slogan these days says, "If no fat touches my lips, then no fat reaches my hips." but that is simply not true. Our war on dietary fat really began in earnest 15 years ago as fat phobia became the norm, and the results are now clear. Americans have become more obese than anyone on the face of the earth. Obviously, fat was not the enemy. If fat isn't the enemy, then what is? The answer is insulin. It's excess insulin that makes you fat and keeps you fat. And your body produces excessive amounts of insulin when you eat either too many fat-free carbohydrates or too many calories at a meal. Therefore, when I talk about the zone, it is really a zone of insulin. Not too high, not too low. A zone of insulin controlled by your diet. Throughout this audiobook, I will refer to my program as the Zone Diet. Most people think of diets as a limited time they live in a state of deprivation that allows them to return to old eating habits. The Zone Diet is neither. It is not deprivation because while you're in the zone, you maintain peak mental and physical performance while consuming the foods you'd like to eat. Being in the zone is a lifetime habit, not a short-term fad. The hormonal responses generated by food that allow you to reach the zone haven't changed for the past 100,000 years, and they are not going to change in your lifetime. Like any lifestyle change, getting into the zone takes patience and practice. But within 2 weeks, if not sooner, you'll begin to see a dramatic change in your life. Carbohydrate cravings will be gone, mental focus increased, physical performance will be enhanced, and you will lose excess body fat at the fastest possible rate. And you will be well on your way to achieving super health. That's the kind of lifestyle change anyone should be happy to swallow. This audiobook is divided into three basic parts. The first describes how to determine your unique protein and carbohydrate requirements and how they work together to form your hormonal carburetor. The second part deals with the construction of balanced zone meals. The final part provides helpful hints that will allow you to stay in the zone for a lifetime. If super health is what you want to achieve, then reaching the zone and staying there is the way to make it happen. Treat this audiobook as a personal user's guide. Once you're in the zone, why would you ever want to leave? You're nearly ready to travel toward the zone, but like any trip, some preparation is necessary before you begin the journey. Reaching the zone is all about insulin control. The most important step to control insulin is fulfilling your body's unique protein requirements. Why is protein so important? First, your body requires incoming protein on a continuous basis to repair and maintain its critical systems. Your muscles, your immune system, and every enzyme in your body is composed of protein. Every day, your body loses protein constantly. Without adequate incoming dietary protein, these critical body functions begin to run down. But more importantly, the reason that protein is so vital is because it stimulates the hormone glucagon. Glucagon has the opposite physiological action to insulin. In fact, glucagon acts as the major governor of excessive insulin production. It is excess insulin that makes you fat, makes you hungry, makes you mentally foggy, decreases your physical performance, and increases the likelihood of chronic disease. The maximum amount of protein you should eat at a meal is approximately 5 ounces of skinless chicken breast, or its equivalent. Of course, your protein requirement is unique to you and no one else. So can you be even more precise about exactly how much protein you need? The answer is yes. And to make it very easy for you to actually apply, use, and remember just how much protein you need, I have created a nutritional measurement, which I call a block. You can apply the block method to any source of protein, be it tofu, tuna, or a steak fillet. Your stomach breaks all of them down into simple amino acids for absorption. My blocks all contain 7 grams of protein. One block of protein could be 1 ounce of meat, such as sliced turkey, chicken, or beef. One block of protein could be 1.5 ounces of fish, or 2 egg whites, or 1/4 cup of cottage cheese, or 3 ounces of extra firm tofu. It's all equal to your body. One practical reason I like using blocks is so you can measure the amount of protein you need at each meal on the fingers of one hand. Using blocks, you now have a more precise way to determine how much protein is in the food that you eat. You can also use blocks to tell you how much protein you need at each meal. If you are the typical American female, you will need between 2 and 3 blocks of protein at every meal. And if you are the typical American male, you will need between 3 and 4 blocks of protein at every meal. What if you want even greater precision? First, you have to determine your percent body fat. Then from that, you can determine your lean body mass. And from your lean body mass, you begin to figure out exactly how much protein you need every day. What is lean body mass? You can view your body as consisting of 2 components. The first is your total fat mass. The other component of your total weight is everything else. This everything else component is known as lean body mass. Lean body mass consists of water, muscle, bones, tendons, etc. Your body requires adequate levels of protein to maintain this amount of lean body mass. Obviously, you don't require any incoming dietary protein to maintain your fat mass. Determining your total fat mass can be a downright scary proposition, but you have to do it to establish your starting point. Simply multiply your total weight by your percent body fat. For example, if you weigh 160 pounds and have 25% body fat, then your total fat mass will be 40 pounds. This means that 40 pounds of pure fat is sitting on your body. Since fat contains 3,500 calories per pound, this means you have approximately 140,000 calories of stored usable fat energy. So if you have 40 pounds of total fat, then what is your lean body mass? Simply subtract your total fat mass, 40 pounds, from your total weight, 160 pounds. What is left behind is 120 pounds of lean body mass. This measure gives you half of your protein prescription. The other half of your protein prescription is determined by how active you are. The more active you are, the more protein you will need. To calculate your protein requirements, multiply your lean body mass by your physical activity factor. Now, we're finally ready to determine your protein prescription, the number of grams of protein that you will require to maintain your lean body mass. Just multiply your lean body mass by your activity factor. Never consume any more protein than your body needs to maintain your lean body mass, but never consume less. Eating too little is to subject yourself to protein malnutrition. In other words, stay in balance. By eating small amounts of protein throughout the day, you are spreading your protein requirement evenly into your body. For example, if you had 120 pounds of lean body mass and were sedentary, you would require 60 grams of protein per day. 120 pounds of lean body mass times 1/2 gram of protein per pound of lean body mass. Now divide that 60 grams of protein by 7 grams of protein per block, and you see that you would require about 9 blocks of protein per day. This is not to say you have to eat animal protein to be on the zone diet. On the contrary, there are several great vegetarian sources of protein that you can use on this program. One of the best is firm or extra firm tofu. Most of the carbohydrates have been fermented out of this type of tofu, making it very protein-rich. Soft tofu, on the other hand, has not been fermented as much and is much richer in carbohydrate. In many ways, firm and extra firm tofu is the vegetarian equivalent of cottage cheese. Unfortunately, tofu is not very protein-dense, so you have to use a lot, about 3 ounces, to get 1 block of protein. However, some of the inherent limitations of tofu have been overcome by a new generation of soybean-based imitation meat products that actually taste pretty good. Soybean hamburgers, hot dogs, sausages are all interesting sources that can provide appropriate levels of protein into a vegetarian diet. Taking this one step further, there's also a new generation of soybean protein powders called soybean protein isolates, which are not only very protein dense, but also contain a complete spectrum of amino acids. Adding protein powder to a meal can be another great way to improve the hormonal balance of a purely vegetarian menu. What about other traditional vegetarian sources of protein? Unfortunately, they carry either massive amounts of carbohydrate with them, or they are not very protein dense. Furthermore, the high fiber content in such vegetarian sources prevents a significant amount of the protein from being digested. Rather than having to make all these correction factors, just make life easier for yourself and treat beans, broccoli, and other vegetable sources as excellent forms of carbohydrates and forget their protein content. Knowing how much protein you need is only the first step toward the zone. A zone diet is not a high-protein diet. Is a protein-adequate diet. But to have the zone diet work correctly, you actually have to consume slightly more carbohydrate than protein. And like protein, there are limits on carbohydrate consumption, not too much nor too little. Just how much is the question that begs to be answered. We are led to believe that all carbohydrates are the closest thing to manna from heaven. After all, carbohydrates are fat-free. Just as Americans have become obsessive about fat-free foods, they have simultaneously embraced the idea that eating carbohydrates is next to godliness. You're told that if you're an athlete, eating them will make you run faster. If you're a cardiovascular patient, they will make you well. If you are fat, eating them will make you thin. Sound familiar? It should, because virtually every nutritional publication in this country espouses the moral superiority of carbohydrates to any food that contains fat, and that includes protein. Yet millions of those Americans who have worshipped at the altar of carbohydrates for the past 15 years show an amazing degree of ignorance about what carbohydrates actually are. Ask most people, and they will tell you that carbohydrates are pasta, bagels, or sweets. If you look them in the eye and ask them what a fruit or a vegetable is, they'll usually respond by telling you it's a fruit or it's a vegetable, as if these foods are some unique species just recently discovered in an Amazon rainforest. In fact, fruits and vegetables are also carbohydrates. Mankind is genetically designed to eat primarily fruits and vegetables as its major source of carbohydrates. Grains as a reliable source of food simply did not exist 10,000 years ago. Consequently, the great majority of individuals still have not genetically adapted to eating high-density forms of carbohydrates such as grains, starches, bread, and pasta. Carbohydrates act as powerful drugs, a fact most people just don't realize. Excessive carbohydrate consumption causes your body to overproduce insulin. And too much insulin can make you fat and sluggish, and it can be dangerous. Elevated insulin induces foggy thinking by reducing blood sugar levels to the brain. Elevated insulin will decrease your overall physical performance. Most importantly, the biochemical effects from elevated insulin will profoundly affect your health. In fact, elevated insulin is the primary predictor of whether or not you will have a heart attack. All that said, I want to make it clear I am not anti-carbohydrate, but I am pro-balance and pro-moderation with respect to carbohydrates and their effect on insulin. If this sounds like carbohydrate bashing, then let's go back into history and ask just how good carbohydrates were for ancient civilizations. Before the beginning of agriculture, 10,000 years ago, man survived very well by eating low-fat protein and fruits and vegetables. This was the diet of most hunter-gatherer societies. It was only with the beginning of agriculture that people made the corresponding switch to a grain-based diet. Not surprisingly, many diseases of modern civilization appeared during the switch to a grain-based diet. How do we know? The mummies tell us. Ancient Egyptian religion placed a great emphasis on preserving the body of the deceased for the afterlife through mummification. Furthermore, mummification was common in all social classes. What was religion then now gives a powerful scientific tool, as mummies give us an excellent physical sampling of ancient Egyptian society. Ancient Egyptians were the first society to follow the guidelines in the new U.S. food pyramid. They ate lots of bread, some vegetables and fruits, small amounts of meat in the form of fish and waterfowl, and their only fat came from olives. If there's ever an ideal society to study the effects of a high-carbohydrate, low-fat diet, it would be the ancient Egyptians. And what do the mummies have to tell us? First, many of the diseases that we assume only appeared with the advent of modern civilization were in full bloom in the ancient Egyptian society. Tooth decay is one. Although the Egyptians ate no refined sugar, they suffered from terrible tooth decay. This isn't all that surprising when you realize that chewing bread long enough will release massive amounts of sugar into the mouth. Tooth decay is one thing. What about heart disease? The ancient Egyptian diet is similar to the diet recommended by doctors in the United States today to prevent heart disease. You would like to think there should be no trace of heart disease in mummies. Wrong. Analysis of dissected arteries from mummies indicates extensive signs of advanced heart disease. In fact, there are estimates that the extent of heart disease in ancient Egypt wasn't all that different from present-day America. Furthermore, the medical texts of ancient Egypt written nearly 3,500 years ago leave a clear impression that heart disease was widespread. In those texts are descriptions of the symptoms of a heart attack that could have been written yesterday by the American Heart Association. And if that isn't enough, remember the average age of death in ancient Egypt was far younger than today, which means heart disease appeared to be rampant in a much younger population. Finally, what about obesity? Following the ancient Egyptian diet, it would be virtually impossible for anyone to be fat, right? Wrong again. The excess skin flaps in the midsection of mummies indicate extensive obesity in the ancient Egyptians. Of course, no one has ever seen a fat Egyptian in hieroglyphics. Why? Probably for the same reason that anthropologists 2,000 years from now will never see a fat American female in an unearthed copy of Cosmopolitan or Vogue. Excess body fat simply didn't play well in ancient Egypt, just as it doesn't play well in present-day America. You don't have to rely upon the study of ancient Egyptians to come to the same conclusions about excess consumption of grains and starches. For example, there was a study published in 1996 in Lancet that demonstrated that Italians who consumed the highest levels of pasta had the highest levels of breast cancer. But nowhere did you see any headline in any leading newspaper stating that pasta increases the risk of breast cancer. Obviously, pasta bashing is politically incorrect. Furthermore, there are two other studies from the same research group in Italy indicating that excessive pasta consumption is also linked to increases in colon cancer and stomach cancer. On the other hand, every major study has indicated that people who increased their consumption of fruits and vegetables had reduced rates of cancer and heart disease. All this leads me to the quick zone rule on carbohydrates. Let most of your carbohydrate consumption come from fruits and vegetables, and use grains, starches, pasta, and bread in moderation. Eating more fruits and vegetables and fewer grains, starches, and pasta is a good way to begin heading toward the zone. But can you become even more precise in controlling insulin? The answer is definitely yes. To start, you'll need a consistent measurement of the amount of carbohydrate in the foods you eat in order to determine their ability to stimulate insulin secretion. Simply apply the block method to carbohydrates. The amount of insulin your body will produce is based upon only the amount of carbohydrate that actually enters into the bloodstream as a simple sugar glucose. Fiber doesn't count. Therefore, when calculating carbohydrate blocks, you subtract the fiber to end up with the actual amount of carbohydrate that actually enters the bloodstream. This insulin-promoting carbohydrate is what I count in order to construct my easy-to-use carbohydrate blocks. For example, 1.5 cups of broccoli has the same amount of insulin-promoting carbohydrate as 1/4 cup of cooked pasta. Anyone can eat 1 cup of cooked pasta, but eating 6 cups of cooked broccoli is pretty hard work. Yet they both contain the same amount of insulin-promoting carbohydrate. Since the Zone diet recommends eating primarily fruits and vegetables for its carbohydrate sources, it is a diet that is exceptionally rich in fiber, yet moderate in the amount of insulin-promoting carbohydrates consumed. Ultimately, all carbohydrate blocks contain 9 grams of insulin-promoting carbohydrate. Why 9 grams? Because 9 grams of insulin-promoting carbohydrate is the exact amount you need to match the 7 grams of protein in my definition of a protein block. Now, all you have to do is keep the amount of protein blocks equal to the amount of carbohydrate blocks at any meal. One added complicating factor for carbohydrates is the glycemic index. The higher the glycemic index of a carbohydrate, the faster the rise in blood sugar. All carbohydrates, whether simple or complex, have to be broken down into simple sugars before being absorbed by the body and entering the bloodstream. The only simple sugar that can actually enter the bloodstream is glucose. And the faster glucose appears in the bloodstream, the more insulin you make. Therefore, carbohydrates with a high glycemic index will have a greater effect on insulin secretion compared to carbohydrates with a lower glycemic index. You might think that simple carbohydrates would enter the bloodstream faster than complex carbohydrates. When the first experiments were done at the University of Toronto, this often wasn't the case. Some simple carbohydrates, such as table sugar, enter the bloodstream more slowly than more seemingly dietetically correct breakfast cereals, such as cornflakes. In other cases, it was found that the sugar in ice cream was entering the bloodstream as glucose far slower than complex carbohydrates found in a bagel. What was going on? It turns out a lot of things were. First, let's look at table sugar. Table sugar is 1/2 glucose and 1/2 fructose, which is quickly broken down into both simple sugars. The glucose half is rapidly absorbed and enters the bloodstream quickly because it's already in the form your body can use. Fructose, although rapidly absorbed, has to be converted into glucose in the liver before it enters the bloodstream in a usable form of glucose. And this is a very slow process. The end result is that the overall rise in blood sugar is retarded. Since fruits primarily contain fructose, they have a very low glycemic index and stimulate insulin production far less than other carbohydrates, such as grains or starches. For instance, the long-considered dietetically correct breakfast cereal is essentially pure glucose linked by chemical bonds. These bonds are very easily broken in the stomach, allowing glucose to rush into the bloodstream at a faster rate than the carbohydrate from table sugar. Therefore, it's time to rethink what is simple and what is complex. Then consider ice cream, which also has a low glycemic index. The fat in the ice cream acts like a control rod, slowing the entry of any carbohydrate into the bloodstream. That's why the sugar in ice cream enters the bloodstream at a much slower rate than the glucose in a bagel. Fiber can also play a role in determining the glycemic index, but not all fiber. There are two types of fiber, soluble and insoluble. Insoluble fiber includes such things as cellulose and bran, whereas soluble fiber includes such things as pectin, which is found in apples. The soluble fiber represents another type of control rod that slows the rate of entry of any carbohydrate into the bloodstream. The type of fiber you find in a breakfast cereal is insoluble fiber, which has virtually no effect on carbohydrate entry. How you cook a carbohydrate will also have a large effect on its glycemic index. The more you cook or process a carbohydrate, the more you break down its cell structure, allowing faster digestion. This is why refried beans have a much higher glycemic index than slightly cooked kidney beans. And when you go to convenience carbohydrates, such as instant potatoes and instant rice, the glycemic index is dramatically increased. Obviously, you pay a hormonal price for convenience. And the food with perhaps the highest glycemic index on record? It's those puffed rice cakes that have become the staple of every dieter on a high-carbohydrate, low-fat program. Finally, let me say a word about alcohol. For all intents and purposes, the body treats alcohol as if it were a carbohydrate. As a result, any alcohol consumption has to be treated as if you're consuming carbohydrates. And each type of alcohol represents a different carbohydrate block amount. Here's another zone rule on carbohydrates. Primarily use carbohydrates that are both low density, thereby providing maximum fiber, vitamins, and minerals, and low glycemic, so carbohydrates enter the blood at a slow and controlled rate. Conversely, unfavorable carbohydrates are high density and high glycemic carbohydrates. This is not to say you can never eat unfavorable carbohydrates, only that they should be used with greater moderation, probably no more than 1/4 of your total carbohydrate blocks, especially if you are genetically prone to being insulin sensitive to carbohydrates. How can you tell your degree of insulin sensitivity to carbohydrates without complicated medical testing? Simply eat a big pasta meal at lunch, and if you begin falling asleep by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you are insulin sensitive to carbohydrates. Bear in mind that being insulin sensitive is very different than having a constantly elevated levels of insulin. This is called hyperinsulinemia. When you are hyperinsulinemic, you are now fast-tracking yourself to a heart attack. If you have an existing heart condition, you are also probably hyperinsulinemic, and it's likely you came from that genetic pool of individuals who are genetically prone to producing high levels of insulin in response to any carbohydrate. Now, of course, your body does need a constant intake of carbohydrate for optimal brain function. Too little carbohydrate in the bloodstream and your brain will not function efficiently. Too much carbohydrate in the bloodstream and your body responds by increasing the secretion of insulin to drive down blood sugar to a level too low to allow your brain to function effectively. What your body needs is a zone of incoming carbohydrate. Not too much, not too little, just like protein. This maintains a zone of insulin. As I said before, elevated insulin is the reason you get fat and stay fat. But just how does excess carbohydrate consumption and corresponding insulin secretion increase your body fat? Insulin is your body's storage and locking hormone. The elevated insulin levels generated from a large carbohydrate meal prevent your body from using any of its stored body fat for energy. In other words, it prevents you from burning the fat you already have. Humans can store unlimited amounts of excess calories as fat. And insulin is the key trigger in a unique evolutionary mechanism that has evolved to limit the immediate use of incoming dietary fat for energy as long as excess carbohydrates are available in the bloodstream. Since incoming dietary fat is not used immediately for energy, the elevated presence of insulin due to higher carbohydrate intake will ensure that this incoming dietary fat is driven into the adipose tissue for future storage, a clever but insidious process in the land where carbohydrate is king. The same evolutionary process is why the combination of fat and excess carbohydrates in a meal can be such an accelerator for fat accumulation. Fear not. By now you have the beginnings of some very powerful dietary tools to work with to decrease insulin secretion caused by carbohydrates. Protein stimulates glucagon, which reduces insulin secretion, and fat and fiber slow down the rate of entry of any carbohydrate to further reduce insulin secretion. Use these tools wisely. Here is a summary of some simple zone rules on carbohydrates. Eat primarily low-density carbohydrates like fruits and most fiber-rich vegetables. Make sure you consume primarily carbohydrates that have a low glycemic index. Keep track of the total number of carbohydrate blocks you're consuming in a given meal. By eating low-density carbohydrates, it is very easy to avoid overconsumption of carbohydrate blocks. And the amount of carbohydrate you need to consume to maintain insulin in a tight zone, that is determined by the amount of protein you require at the same meal. This is the essence of the zone diet, the balance of protein and carbohydrate at every meal. However, you need one last critical ingredient, the most dreaded three-letter word in America, fat. As ironic as it sounds, it does take fat to burn fat. How can fat be such an ally in burning your own stored body fat? First, incoming dietary fat has no effect on insulin. Carbohydrate is the major stimulator of insulin, and even protein can have a slight stimulatory effect on insulin. But fat is a big zero when it comes to insulin stimulation. So eating fat will not cause your body to store more fat. Second, fat slows down the entry of carbohydrates into the bloodstream. The slower the rate that carbohydrates enter the bloodstream, the lower the insulin production. And the lower the insulin levels, the more likely you are to release stored body fat for energy. Third, fat causes the release of the hormone cholecystokinin, or CCK, from the stomach that goes directly to your brain to say, stop eating. So in essence, fat is your primary hormonal off signal for eating. Therefore, when you take much of the fat out of your diet and replace it with carbohydrate, you not only rob food of its taste, but you distort the hormonal signals that stop you from overconsuming calories and increase your likelihood of storing fat by increasing insulin levels. Just add enough additional fat to your diet to help your body reduce insulin secretion. Though fat has no direct effect on insulin, you do want to keep your intake of saturated fat low. All the membranes in your body operate best in a zone of fluidity. If the membranes are too fluid, they don't provide the rigidity required for proper function. They begin to look like a Salvador Dali watch. The body recognizes this fact and will make enough saturated fat to increase the viscosity of the membrane to maintain the necessary fluidity zone, even though you're eating no saturated fat at all. On the other hand, if you're eating a lot of saturated fat, the cell membranes become too rigid and resemble molasses in winter. Since the body has no mechanism to make polyunsaturated fat, it is unable to improve the fluidity of the membrane. In this rigid membrane environment, your body's receptors, especially the insulin receptor, don't function very well, and the body has to pump out more insulin to bring down blood sugar levels. This leads to insulin resistance and eventually hyperinsulinemia. Therefore, it simply makes good sense to keep your saturated fat intake to a minimum. While reducing saturated fat is strongly recommended, you do need a constant intake of polyunsaturated fats, which are the building blocks of eicosanoids. Eicosanoids are the most powerful hormones in your body. They control every cell, every organ, every system. Only a handful of physicians know about them, let alone the general public. This is because these hormones are extremely short-lived, never travel through the bloodstream, and are all but invisible to scientific study. Yet, in a sense, they are the molecular glue that holds your body together. These are the hormones that dictate whether or not you suffer a heart attack, how well you rally your immune system, whether or not you have pain or inflammation, plus a myriad of other controlling functions. Yet, as with all hormonal systems, their function is a matter of balance. And what can destroy the delicate balance of eicosanoids? An overproduction of insulin. What excessive levels of insulin cause is a corresponding overproduction of one particular polyunsaturated fatty acid called arachidonic acid. Your body needs some arachidonic acid because you will always need some amount of bad eicosanoids to maintain that hormonal balance. However, excessive levels of this fatty acid may be one of the most dangerous items you will ever encounter. Many chronic disease conditions, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, arthritis, and others are a consequence of elevated levels of beta-carotenoids derived from arachidonic acid. And where do you find excessive levels of arachidonic acid? In fatty red meats, egg yolks, and organ meats. Simply avoiding dietary sources rich in arachidonic acid is not enough. You should also avoid consuming too much of another kind of polyunsaturated fat known as omega-6 essential fatty acids. With excessive intake of this type of polyunsaturated fat, you run another risk, as you can now potentially begin to overload your system and force it into making too many beta-carotenoids and create a hormonal cascade that can usually undermine your efforts to achieve super health. What are common sources rich in omega-6 fatty acids? Primarily oils like sunflower, safflower, and soybean. Since you will get all the omega-6 essential fatty acid that you need by eating adequate levels of low-fat protein, you want to keep any added dietary fat sources rich in omega-6 fatty acids limited. What your body really needs are adequate amounts of another type of polyunsaturated fats called omega-3 fatty acids, particularly the most important fatty acid in this family called eicosapentaenoic acid, or EPA. EPA helps your body avoid the same negative hormonal cascade that excess intakes of omega-6 fatty acids can trigger. The best source of EPA is found in fish. This should be a primary dietary goal. If you don't like fish, you can always get some EPA in your diet the same way your grandmother did, by taking cod liver oil. If you're restricting the amounts of saturated fat and arachidonic acid, moderating the amounts of omega-6 polyunsaturated fats while taking in relatively limited amounts of omega-3 essential fatty acids like EPA, then what type of fat should you eat to help yourself burn fat? The answer is monounsaturated fat. Excellent sources of monounsaturated fat are olives, avocado, and certain nuts such as macadamia, pistachio, cashew, and almond. As with protein and carbohydrate blocks, there are also fat blocks. A fat block is only 1.5 grams of fat, which translates into one macadamia nut or 1/3 a teaspoon of olive oil. As you can see, this is not a program of fat gluttony, but a method of adding back controlled amounts of fat to get the maximum tuning of what I call your hormonal carburetor. And it is learning how to use your hormonal carburetor that is the true key to mastering the zone. Reaching the zone is all about keeping insulin in a tight range. You can't run your body all on carbohydrate or all protein. You need a combination of both. You need a hormonal carburetor. Unfortunately, your body doesn't come fully installed. That's where the zone diet comes in. It keeps insulin in a tight range and things running smoothly so that you can extend your own mileage. Since no two people are alike, the range of effective protein to carbohydrate ratios for this hormonal carburetor will vary. But for everyone, it has boundaries. These boundaries are based upon the ratio of insulin-promoting carbohydrates to protein consumed at every meal. For the vast majority of individuals, this carburetor works best at a 1-to-1 ratio of protein to carbohydrate blocks. First, you have to learn how to maintain this carburetor. As with all science, the more precise you are, the better the results. Your eye can provide you with a pretty good indicator of how you're doing in terms of hitting this ratio. Not surprisingly, I call this technique the eyeball method. Not as precise as the block method, the eyeball method is easier to follow, especially when dining out. Just use this simple rule. Whatever the amount of low-fat protein you plan to eat, let that size, and really the volume, determine the amount of carbohydrates you're going to eat at the same time. If the carbohydrates you plan to eat are unfavorable carbohydrates, grains, starches, pasta, bagels, then make their volume equal to the volume of the low-fat protein portion you're going to eat. If you plan to eat favorable carbohydrates, fruits and vegetables, then you can double the volume of the low-fat protein portion. It won't give you quite the same precise hormonal control as when you use the block method, but at least your hormonal carburetor will never be too far out of tune. Now let's begin learning about the block method. The 1-to-1 ratio of protein to carbohydrate blocks is equivalent of 7 grams of protein for every 9 grams of insulin-promoting carbohydrate. For every protein block and carbohydrate block you consume, you should always add 1 fat block. Always have equal numbers of protein, carbohydrate, and fat blocks at every meal. Since a carbohydrate block, 9 grams, is larger than a protein block, 7 grams, you always consume more carbohydrate than protein at every meal on the zone diet. Moderation is the real key to understanding the zone. Controlling insulin is the key to reaching the zone, but you don't have to give up carbohydrates to achieve that goal, as long as you're willing to pay close attention to the ratio of protein to carbohydrate blocks at each meal. In fact, in a recent clinical study done at the University of Geneva, fat loss in patients following what was essentially a zone diet was exactly the same as the patients following a much more restrictive carbohydrate diet, even though insulin levels were much lower in the highly restrictive carbohydrate diet. This is why the zone diet is based more on balance than elimination. When insulin levels drop too low, many of the negative side effects, fatigue due to electrolyte loss, irritability, constipation, loss of muscle mass associated with the high-protein diets of the 1970s become readily apparent. And this is why the constant balance of protein to carbohydrate at every meal is so important to the zone diet. In many ways, I would liken current extreme diets to the early days of birth control pills, when it was thought that massive amounts of hormones were needed to prevent ovulation. Now we know that far smaller amounts do an excellent job. Likewise, the drastic restriction of carbohydrates will decrease insulin, but you don't have to restrict them nearly as much to lose excess body fat if you pay closer attention to your hormonal carburetor, which you now know is controlled by the protein-to-carbohydrate ratio of the meals you eat. Finally, what about calories? Don't they count? Well, they do and they don't. Let me explain. Caloric thinking says a calorie is a calorie. And since a gram of fat has twice the calories as a gram of carbohydrate, the fastest way to reduce calorie intake is to drastically reduce dietary fat. But hormonal thinking says a calorie of fat has a different hormonal effect than a calorie of protein, which has a still different hormonal effect than a calorie of carbohydrate. So on the zone diet, it's not the number of calories on which you should focus. It's their hormonal effects. This was demonstrated in a classic study by Kerwick and Powen at the Middlesex Hospital in London nearly 40 years ago under hospital ward conditions. Various 1,000-calorie per day diets were compared to see their effect on weight loss. If weight loss was simply a matter of calories, then regardless of the makeup of the calories, all patients would have experienced the same weight loss. Yet a 1,000-calorie-a-day diet, consisting of 90% carbohydrates, actually caused the patients to gain weight. While they lost weight on all other 1,000-calorie-per-day diets that had a much lower carbohydrate content. The hormonal carburetor also takes care of controlling the calorie intake for you. Evolution has equipped us with unique hormonal control mechanisms that tell us to stop eating too many calories. The key player in that hormonal stop is called cholecystokinin, or CCK, and fat is the primary stimulator of CCK. By reducing the fat in a meal, you are in essence short-circuiting your stop-eating hormone. Sound familiar? It probably does if you're on a high-carbohydrate, low-fat, and low-protein diet. Hungry all the time? Don't think you have enough willpower to stop eating so much? You don't need willpower to stop eating calories. You need science. That's what the Zone Diet is all about. But also bear in mind, this is not an invitation to caloric gluttony. Excessive consumption of too many calories, no matter how well balanced hormonally, will lead to the accumulation of excess body fat. But if you stick to your protein prescription, it will be virtually impossible to consume too many calories on the Zone Diet because of all of the hormonal control systems you are putting into play to stop overconsuming total calories. In fact, the Zone Diet is a low-calorie diet ranging from 1,000 to 1,600 calories per day for most individuals. Should you be concerned about achieving the seemingly low number of calories on the Zone Diet? No, because paradoxically, the biggest complaint about the Zone Diet is that people can't eat all their food, particularly if they're consuming most of their carbohydrate blocks in the form of fruits and vegetables with their low carbohydrate densities. To explain this seeming paradox, I have to go into a little more detail. The average American male or female carries at least 100,000 calories of stored body fat on them at any one time. Put into perspective, this is equivalent to eating 1,700 pancakes. That's a pretty big meal. The calories you need are already sitting in your body. You just need a hormonal ATM card to release them. That's what your hormonal carburetor can be viewed as, your internal hormonal ATM card that will help you release some of those fat pancakes on your body. If you have the right hormonal ATM card, you won't have to eat as many calories to provide your daily caloric requirements. This is because the rest of your calories you need to fulfill your energy needs will come from those fat pancakes. On the other hand, if you don't have the correct hormonal ATM code because you're eating a high carbohydrate diet, you'll have to take in more incoming calories, and those 1,700 or more fat pancakes already on your body will still be there. That same hormonal ATM card also lets you maintain a relatively constant blood sugar level by releasing stored carbohydrate from the liver. The end result is you maintain high levels of mental acuity and focus along with a lack of hunger, since the brain is now getting all the blood sugar it needs to function optimally. So once you tune up your hormonal carburetor, you will continually access stored body fat, maintain peak mental alertness, and not be hungry for 4 to 6 hours after a meal. Does it sound like it's worthwhile to control that carburetor at every meal? I would like to think so, unless you want to be continually mentally sluggish, perform poorly throughout the day, and risk being constantly overweight. Obviously, you want to tap into your caloric bank account only until you reach your ideal weight. A good rule of thumb is that your weight as an adult should be what it was at age 18. In reality, there is no ideal weight, only an ideal percent body fat. That will be 15% for males and 22% for females. If you have any questions about your body fat, simply stand stark naked in front of a mirror. If you're a male and don't have any love handles, then you're probably close to 15% body fat. If you're a female and have no cellulite, you're probably about 22% body fat. The Zone Diet is designed as if you're already at your ideal percent body fat, because at that point, you're maintaining your lean body mass while you've used up your extra fat pancakes. Once you get to your ideal percent body fat, don't change your diet. You've already been eating as if you were already there from day one. Since the Zone Diet is controlled by your protein requirements, the only time you ever change your protein intake is when you change your physical activity level or see a significant change in your lean body mass. Can you achieve even a lower percent body fat? Of course you can and should. But it's going to take even more effort, and that usually means exercise. And is there a lower limit when your body fat can become too low? Certainly. For most males, it's about 7%, and for females, about 13%. But now we're talking about world-class athletes. Below these levels of body fat, performance suffers. Individuals in this lower range of body fat will need more incoming calories to prevent their percent of body fat from falling below a level at which performance will be compromised. How do they increase their calories? Will they add more protein to their diet? No, because their protein consumption is already adequate to maintain their lean body mass. Will they add more carbohydrate to their diet? No, because extra carbohydrate will increase insulin and destroy the delicate hormonal carburetor that they are trying to maintain. What's left? The answer is they have to add more fat to their diet. That's right, extra fat. This extra fat acts like a caloric ballast to add more calories to a person's diet and let them maintain a percent body fat at which their performance is optimal. In fact, some of the elite athletes I work with need nearly 60% of their calories as fat to maintain peak performance. But for most elite athletes, their fat content on the Zone diet will be approximately 40 to 45% of total calories. This extra fat should be primarily monounsaturated fat, and should a person's body fat begin to increase beyond a predetermined level, they can simply decrease the amount of extra dietary fat they begin to eat so their percent body fat remains at a level at which they perform best. Before you start buying extra jars of macadamia nuts or bottles of olive oil, remember we are talking about very lean, highly athletic individuals. Here are some simple rules to determine the level of leanness for males. If you don't have any love handles, then you are about 15% body fat. When you can raise your arm and see your ribs, then you have about 13% body fat. At about 10% body fat, you can clearly see your abdominal muscles. If you're a female, simply add another 7 percentage points to the male numbers at each level of leanness, and the same criteria apply. When you can see your abs for both male and female, then it's time to start adding more fat to your diet. And this is the only difference between diets designed for Olympic athletes and type 2 diabetic patients. The Olympic athletes will need more protein because of their greater lean body mass and higher levels of physical activity, and more fat to maintain their percent body fat in an ideal range. Other than that, their meal plans are virtually identical. Constructing Zone meals all starts with your individual protein prescription. Simply take the blocks of protein you require in the course of a day and spread these blocks throughout the day like you would a prescription drug. Your daily meal plan is going to consist of 3 meals per day and 2 snacks, each snack consisting of 1 block. Never let more than 5 hours go by without a Zone meal or snack. The body requires food intake on a relatively precise time schedule, just like taking a drug. This timing will maintain the appropriate hormonal levels throughout the day. You'll want to have another hormonal touch-up before you go to bed because you're entering into an 8-hour cycle of sleep. This late-night snack sets the stage for the correct hormonal environment to facilitate all of the repair processes that take place during sleep. In addition, it prevents any nocturnal hypoglycemia, as your brain will still require a supply of energy throughout the night. In fact, the best time to eat is when you're not hungry, which means your blood sugar levels are being maintained. Once you know your protein block requirements, the only thing you have to remember is the size of the blocks of the protein sources you'd like to eat. For every protein block in a meal or snack, plan to add 1 carbohydrate block. So far, it seems pretty easy. Now here's the hardest part for most people to grasp. You have to add fat, especially if you want to lose excess body fat. As paradoxical as this sounds, it's true if you understand hormonal thinking. If you really want to control insulin, you have to always add some extra fat to your meals. But remember, you're adding just enough fat to tune up your hormonal carburetor. By reducing everything you eat to pre-calculated food blocks, you now have a mathematically precise way of adjusting your hormonal carburetor based on the food you like to eat and therefore will eat. Everything is based upon your protein prescription. To show you how simple it is, let's talk about some examples of 4 blocks of protein, carbohydrate, and fat. Obviously, 14 strips of bacon is not your best possible protein choice, but that is the amount you would require if bacon was your protein choice. Other choices such as 4 ounces of skinless chicken breast, or 6 ounces of flounder, or 1 cup of egg substitutes, or even 12 ounces of firm tofu are all better choices. Every one of these choices contains 4 blocks of protein. Now that you've chosen your protein for a meal, it's time to choose a carbohydrate that contains 4 blocks. Obviously, like bacon, a Snickers bar would not be your best choice, but it does contain 4 blocks of carbohydrate. If pasta is your choice, your 4 blocks doesn't give you much to eat, because 2 ounces would wipe out all your carbohydrate allotment for that meal. How about the contents of 3 bags of vegetables? Although this would seem like a lot of food, the high fiber content